From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. I'm Sam Evans Brown. Back toward the end of the summer, I went down to New Jersey to meet a guy.
Me?
This guy.
Tony Bosco.
Tony Bosco.
Just a regular Jersey guy from Jersey, you know?
Despite what he says, Tony is not a regular guy from New Jersey. When he was about 30 years old, he was looking to simplify.
Since I was little, I just wanted to go and live in the woods. So I says, well, you know, why not? What's stopping me from doing it? Nothing. So I did it, you know? I carried, for the longest time, not one key. The more keys you got on your hip, the more responsibility and, you know, maybe stress you have. I carried no keys, you know, except the combination lock on my bicycle.
Now, if that sounds nice, you should know that most people would have said that during this time, Tony was technically homeless. But Tony called it something else, camping.
So I had been camping in 89, probably up until 3 years ago, which would be, 2012 when I got injured. And that's a pretty long time. I guess that's more than 20 years.
It's 23 years. He says he was living outdoors for 23 years. This week on Outside In, two stories about fighting the odds. First up, the tale of Tony Bosco, who hid in plain sight for more than two decades in the most densely populated state in the nation. How did he do it? Tony grew up in Piscataway, New Jersey, and he grew up in a pretty standard New Jersey way. He played football on the state champion team, he chased girls, raised hell, got all kinds of lousy grades, but he also fished and camped and read some books, too.
Oh, yeah, that was my side of the mountain. I guess it was 1967 when I read the book, My Side of the Mountain.
You remember My Side of the Mountain, right? Boy runs away from New York City to live in the Catskills, tames a peregrine falcon, befriends a weasel.
This is to be my first entry in my journal. I will keep it religiously, just as Thoreau did his.
When I read it, it just, like I said, it opened my mind to alternatives. I don't have to live in a house.
Tony graduated high school and worked odd jobs for a number of years. He moved to Florida and worked for AT&T and driving a limo.
I guess AT&T and driving a limo was my last straw. I just didn't like it. I liked Florida, but the pay scale was real low. And it's like, you gotta work all the time, you know? And then too much work and no play, you know?
So Tony moved back home and just decided to walk away from it all.
I never went for the career. I always changed jobs every 3 years, all my life. I never wanted a mortgage. I didn't want a career. I just wanted to go out and play. That's all I wanted to do.
Now, right here at the outset, I need to get something out of the way. The word homeless.
Oh, yeah, I was very touchy about being called homeless. I'm not homeless. These boots sit, or my pro kets, wherever they're at, I'm not homeless no matter what. I'm a camper, you know? I'm not a homeless person. I've never been homeless. Never.
Tony feels pretty strongly about this fact. And as you'll see, Tony is not really representative of homelessness in a lot of ways. But let's be honest, he's not really representative of your average camper either. The patch of forest that Tony spent most of his years camping in was a piece of land owned by Rutgers University called Kilmer Woods.
You know, and back in here, I know every one of these trees. This wasn't a path. None of this was here. These apartments weren't here. This was wilderness right here. I mean, woods.
When you're in New Jersey, you've got maybe a slightly lower bar for your definition of wilderness, Kilmer Woods is about 370 acres. To put that in perspective, if you set up camp in the deepest part of the forest, you'd never be more than a quarter mile from paved roads. Tony's shelter was maybe a couple of hundred yards from the nearest apartment building and just a few hundred feet from the nearest trail. Now, maybe you read about the hermit who lived in some woods in central Maine for 27 years, stealing food and supplies from second homes and summer camps that whole time, until he was finally caught. That was a crazy story. But that was also Maine, where there are huge tracts of forest that you can hide out in. This is a tiny island of second-growth forest in the middle of a sprawling suburban center. But the stakes are the same. He's on private property. If he gets caught, he's probably going to be arrested, and he's definitely going to get kicked out. So, how does someone live unnoticed on university property for years?
Seclusion. Don't put down footpaths. Don't disturb the foliage. You got to be able to blend and always wear earth tones, not black. Black stands out like white in the woods. You got to wear the earth tones, the browns, the grays, the greens.
Tony's shelter is tall enough so you can sit up in it, but not stand. It's low so that it's harder to spot through the scrub. It's got screens to keep the bugs out, windows and doors. It's made of leftover construction materials and painted to blend in. There are branches and pine boughs strewn all around it.
These were all standing up like this. I put this here. That grew. But all these pieces of wood, all them, all this, everything laying on the ground, I put here. It was a fence that went like this, like this, like this.
The brush in Kilmer Woods is thick, and Tony would strategically weave saplings together and arrange dead fallen branches, even haul in old Christmas trees that people threw out each year. He would thicken the woods up in certain places to subtly redirect anyone who had decided to leave the trail. Even people like Nick Zarula. He used to ride his bike through Kilmer Woods when he was a kid, and he knows it pretty well.
Honestly, my mind is blown because we weren't only riding there, we were digging there. And we were building stuff maybe we shouldn't, like jump trails and stuff, and we never ran into anybody.
Nick is a guy who does commercial video work, and he's from Piscataway originally.
And when him and I met the first time, we had lunch. And I said to him that I thought I had almost found him once because I had found a deer path or a tunnel, and he laughed. And he goes, well, where'd you end up? And I said, nowhere. And he goes, exactly, because that's where I wanted you to end up.
Whatever your feelings about how fun it is to go camping, doing it night after night doesn't seem to be great for you. Every shred of information that we have shows that being homeless is bad for your health. Homeless people are more likely to die of drug overdoses, more likely to die of cancer, and somewhere between 2 and 6 times more likely to die, period. And when you dig in to look at just the population who are sleeping rough, which is what we call it when people aren't sleeping in shelters or on friends' couches, the numbers get even worse. Because of this, there's even a saying that advocates for people experiencing homelessness like to use: housing is healthcare. But Tony is kind of an anomaly. He's organized. To hear him tell it, he doesn't have any problems with drugs or alcohol. He wore clean clothes that he took to the laundry every week. He was usually employed. He says he worked in construction under the table for years, but also managed nightclubs and was a security guard, worked for the local Roman Catholic diocese. He even did volunteer work at churches to help out homeless people. Now, I will say it does drive certain homeless advocates crazy whenever they hear about people who have, quote, chosen to be homeless, unquote, because there's often this backstory of poverty and trauma that makes it so that choice was not particularly freely made. Saying that people choose homelessness is seen as a way to justify not spending any resources to help them. But again, Tony seems to be an outlier. He's got good relationships with his sisters, got along with his parents, he was very employable. But still, he went camping. To get a sense of how unusual Tony is, I spoke to a bunch of healthcare professionals, homelessness advocates, and also talked to a couple of guys who asked to be identified as Alex and Tim.
You guys have a second?
who have both spent time homeless and sleeping rough.
Do you mind being interviewed?
No.
All right.
So what do you have to worry about when you live outside, day after day?
Your feet?
Yeah, definitely see a lot of trench foot and a lot of immersion foot.
And they have trench feet.
Yeah, because you can imagine, if you're always wearing your shoes all day long, you know, you never get a chance to take off your feet for your feet to cool off. And then they get kind of like warm from the moisture. It just sucks, the moist.
Trench foot, like Vietnam. Tony never got that.
Rotating your shoes is important because you want to use them, let them air out, use another pair. Let them air out, use another pair, so you don't constantly get foot issues. I myself have never had foot issues.
You've also got to stay fed. Tony ate lots of junk food. In his shelter, he had hundreds of flattened Little Debbie packages. And on the backs of the boxes, he wrote little notes about the weather, errands he needed to run, or food that he ate.
So let's see what this one says. Pizza. I must have had pizza.
Other signs of his diet? Around his campsite, there were bones scattered everywhere.
Rib bone, jawbone. Yep, judging by the size, I'd say it was a 1.5-year-old doe.
Tony used to hunt deer out in these woods. He was a bow hunter. Often, he was hunting illegally, but he justified it in his own mind.
In New Jersey, you're allowed per person, legally, like 100 deer. We got deer, it makes the news when they come across that river and get hit right there. These giant bucks get hit right there.
I checked up on this, and that's mostly true. In about 2/3 of New Jersey, there is no limit on the number of female deer you can shoot, as long as you have a permit. So it seems like Tony's diet was equal parts junk food, eating at bars and restaurants, and occasionally shooting deer. Now, while New Jersey might not be quite as cold as New Hampshire, even so, in the winter, you've got to watch out for frostbite.
Cold has scientifically been proven. It makes you dumb.
There's probably 6 or 7, maybe closer to 10 patients here right now who've had amputations from frostbite.
Exposed areas, fingers, toes, usually.
Tony dressed well for the cold, wearing layers, and was a big fan of technical fabrics like what you'd find in an outdoor store. But his winter sleeping system is not something you'll find in an REI catalog.
But I always, you know, not for nothing, I slept in the raw, you know, and I just can't sleep with clothes on. But I slept in the raw all year round.
Oh, how does this guy not have frostbite?
Futons. My favorite was a Tony the hot dog. I would be like a hot dog in my little sheds, and they would bend like this.
Tony's shelters were always a little bit too narrow for the futon mattresses he would buy. So the futon would fold up on either side, and he would just nestle in the middle, like the fillings of a taco.
So the futons, you get the nice 6-inch ones, because the 9-inch ones are hard to carry out into the woods. Make sure they're black, and you get the futons. You buy them anywhere. Buy a replacement futon. I get a brand new one, paint the place really nice, and then you have the futon that goes like this. And then you have the sleeping bag and the sheets on top of the futon, the sheets, and tuck them in and stuff, you know.
Oof. Okay, so related pitfall, keeping your bed and yourself clean.
You gotta sleep clean. You have to stay clean.
Because if you don't...
They have much more dermatological infestations, scabies, lice, crabs.
A lot of people are kind of uncleanly, but it's because they have nowhere to do and they just don't know how to do what they have to do.
Tony's camp was right near a little brook, which he would wash off in year-round.
And I would wash every single night. Icicles come off my hair, I didn't care. You gotta go in clean.
But surviving when you're sleeping outside isn't just about keeping healthy. It's also about blending in, trying not to look like you just rolled out of a tent.
So you just don't get stereotyped, you know, just put in a category where everybody's like, oh no, you're a bad person, I don't wanna help you, I don't wanna talk to you.
And this is where I have to point out that the actual survival part of living outside isn't exactly rocket science. The hard part is figuring out how to navigate a world that expects you to live in a damn house.
All I could say is the backpack really infringes. Either you're either a student or a homeless person with that backpack. And that is one thing that you might get looked upon.
Just think, why don't you carry a backpack with you everywhere you go? Why don't you look homeless? It's because, among other reasons, you've got places to stash your stuff.
you really don't fall in love with a materialistic object that you can't carry with you all the time, because you cannot guarantee its safety or it's going to be its whereabouts where you left it. I've had my tent straight up taken. Like, I went back to my tent site, my tent and everything was gone, you know. And I mean, I spent about a month just sleeping underneath the stars, trees, and just doing what I had to do to survive.
And this brings us back to the beginning. Tony's secret spot in Kilmer Woods. Remember all the brush that he used? The deception, the earth tones, all of it to keep his shelter a secret?
Seclusion. Seclusion is A number one. Pick your location. Total seclusion, so you don't have to count on people being honest.
Tony was able to hold jobs because he could keep clean. He could keep clean because he didn't have to wear or carry all of his clothes all the time. He didn't have to carry everything with him because he was reasonably sure that there wasn't much of a chance of people stumbling across his hideout. As an insurance policy, he did keep extra supplies stashed in the nooks and crannies of suburban New Jersey. I watched him pull a strategically located fishing pole out of a drainage pipe in a rock wall. But plan A was to simply melt into the scenery. He would wait until dark to return to his sleeping spot every night. After a few years, he gave up cooking at his campsite or having a fire out there. And so he was able to go unnoticed for years.
When I finally got fed up, with having to have to go to work for a bigger, nicer car, a nicer place, or everybody else's standard. It wasn't mine. I didn't want it. I just didn't want it. Because the more I'd make, the more I just was unhappy. But then I decided, you know, I wanted to work for myself. I wanted to do as I pleased every day. If I want to get up at 3 in the morning, go hunting and fishing, I get up. If I want to sleep until 8 o'clock in the morning, I do that. Nobody's going to bother me except the freaking raccoons occasionally, you know?
When we get down to it, surviving the elements of a New Jersey winter is not incredibly hard. Even up here in northern New England, there are people who spend the whole winter outside. Generally, it's not exposure that kills homeless people.
Talking with somebody recently, asking him, you know, what's your plan for the winter? Are you staying out? And so he's all set. He's got his 3 sleeping bags and, you know, so they plan.
A recent study in Boston found the top cause of death among its homeless population was drug overdose. After that came cancer, mostly lung and liver cancer. So think smoking and drinking, and then not going to the doctor for years. The kinds of death you might associate with survival situations, freezing to death, starvation, dehydration, they didn't even make the list.
When someone seems to not come in from the cold, they are generally very mentally ill, okay? Or very, very, very under the influence or inebriated, you know. Sleeping rough exacerbates those chronic illnesses so much more than in any other context of existence, right?
Well, and I imagine that it probably just exacerbates whatever you're living with.
Yes, whatever, right.
So if we ask ourselves, how did Tony survive all those years of sleeping outside? I'm sure that his secrecy, his hygiene, his systems for keeping warm and employed, they were important. But most of all, he survived because he avoided the worst parts of the human condition. He steered clear of addiction. Tony says he grew marijuana and mostly gave it away, but he did sell some. He talked about a few wild parties down by the river, but he definitely didn't have the kind of deep alcoholism that drives people to constantly have a drink on hand. In 3 days with him, I only saw him drink iced tea, hot coffee, and cold water. Tony Bosco lived outside in central New Jersey for more than 20 years. There were a few brief periods where he had an apartment. Once he went to take care of his father for the final few months of his life, and once he lived in a house that he was taking care of while working for the Catholic Diocese. But in both cases, he says it didn't last more than a couple months.
And I had places to live all the time, you know, but I liked doing what I did.
Eventually, the Rutgers Police Department found his campsite and confiscated his stuff. They left him a note that he could come by and collect it from them. And when he did, they charged him.
Defiant trespassing, because I would build a structure and live on something I wasn't paying taxes on.
He moved on. He found some other camping spots that he could rotate between, but not too much later, about 3 years ago, Tony got into a car accident. He was driving his van when he says another car blew through an intersection, leaving him with 11 damaged vertebrae and unable to work. So he came inside.
They said, you only qualify for supplemental security income, and that's $764 a month, which isn't a lot, but that's that.
These days he's housed, living with a high school friend named Joe. Tony lost a few teeth in the car accident and has put on some weight since getting hurt, but he's alive. Being in his late 50s, he's already outlived most people who spend decades sleeping outside. But when you ask Tony what the future holds for him, it's hard to know what to make of his answer.
There's absolutely nothing wrong with society. I am kind of looking forward to growing up one day and joining. But I'm getting older now, physically, and it's probably time. I don't feel like it's time, but, you know, if push comes to shove, I'll move back out to the woods, you know, and be happy.
Today on the show, two stories about fighting the odds. We've already heard one. Next up is the story of Dr. Percy Julian, a scientist you should have learned about in high school chemistry, but probably didn't.
What Hartley expects an organic chemist to be able to speak without his gobbledygook in his language.
A chemist who fought the odds and changed the face of modern medicine by accident.
And the fellow said, Doctor, something has happened. I said, what? Then I was over the energy.
Dr. Julian's Eureka moment when Outside In continues. This is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. I'm Sam Evans-Brown. Today's show is all about fighting the odds, and joining me for this next story is producer Taylor Quimby.
Hi. Do you know what we're talking about?
No, no idea.
Do you know anything about cone snails?
So cone snails are a genus of about 700 meat-eating mollusks.
They eat meat?
Yeah, but we'll get to that in a minute. They're sea snails, and they range from about less than an inch long to about 9 inches, so they can get pretty big.
These organisms live on or in coral reefs.
And their shells are super cool looking. They're like little works of art. They've got all sorts of different patterns, colors, stripes, polka dots.
One species shell from Conus setanulli, which is known as the matchless cone because of its matchless beauty.
It sold in Holland in 1796 at an auction. And at this auction, the same time, there was a Vermeer painting.
The cone snail shell went for more than five times as many guilders as the Vermeer.
And this, by the way, is a guy named Ari Bernstein. He's a pediatrician and associate director of the Center for Health and the Global Environment at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health.
We have to start a campaign for, like, title shortening.
They gotta cut that back. Anyway, when I was talking to Ari, he posed this very fascinating question.
Cone snails, as I mentioned, are meat-eating mollusks. So how does a snail that's as slow as a proverbial snail catch a fish?
Fish?
Yeah. Cone snails have these long, sort of trunk-like snouts. And inside, there's a teeny harpoon. So a fish swims by and pew! It sticks the fish.
And on that harpoon are somewhere between 200 and 300 peptides that completely destroy the nervous systems of the prey that they hit. So it takes a matter of seconds for a cone snail to completely immobilize a fish. And then they swallow them whole for dramatic effect.
So neurotoxin.
Yeah, and in some of the larger species, these peptides are so powerful they can kill a person, which is why you'll frequently see cone snails featured on those nature documentaries like Deadliest Creatures in the Sea.
The cone snail.
But scientists have discovered that these same poisons that can kill an adult person can be used as an incredible tool. In the 1980s, they developed a new type of painkiller called a ziconotide from a single peptide in a single species of cone snail. Now, this painkiller is 1,000 times more powerful than our most powerful opiates. More importantly, it doesn't produce tolerance, so you don't have to keep ramping it up. And this drug is now successfully used to treat people with AIDS or cancer who are suffering from the very worst types of chronic, unmanageable pain.
For anyone who has had chronic pain, taking care of someone with chronic pain, the idea that a single drug could actually alleviate it entirely is mind-blowing.
So this is what we're talking about today? Cone snails?
Actually, the cone snails were a red herring designed to get you excited about another story.
So we're not talking about cone snails?
No, today we're talking about this connection between modern medicine and the natural world. And it is a story that is going to take us back to the Jim Crow South to see how a black man fought incredible odds to become one of the most prominent chemists of his time and whose work paved the way for the birth control pill. So first, there's a bit of terminology you're going to need to know. In the language of medicine, drugs that come from nature have this vague, corporate-sounding euphemism. They're called natural products. And one of the people who looks for them is a guy named Barry O'Keefe. He's chief of the natural products branch at the National Cancer Institute. And his job is basically to look for bioactive molecules, which is a fancy way of saying it's a molecule that comes from nature and does something. Like anything.
In us.
Yes.
It could be an effect on people, but it also could be effect on an infectious disease. A bioactive molecule could be used to, try and reduce the number of barnacles that attach to ships if you add it to paint, you know.
Yeah, it's a molecule that does a thing to a thing that's alive.
Exactly. But someone like Barry O'Keefe isn't worried about trying to get rid of barnacles. Barry O'Keefe is trying to cure cancer. So here's what that looks like. First, researchers head out into nature to collect thousands and thousands, thousands and thousands and thousands of samples. Plants, marine animals, microbes. Next, each and every one of these samples is ground up or mixed with fluid to create an extract. Imagine a giant laboratory spice rack. Next, scientists take these extracts and they test them. They put them next to cancer cells. They put them next to human enzymes or antibodies. They basically put these extracts in petri dishes with lots of other stuff, and they wait to see what happens. And if something interesting happens, then the hard part starts.
Then chemists, natural products chemists, go about the effort of isolating the active component out of the thousands of molecules in that extract.
Now, is this process a little bit like throwing spaghetti at the wall? I mean, is it just...
Exactly. That's exactly it. We can't predict what molecules will be in all of these extracts. The NCI repository here in Frederick has over 220,000 different extracts. And so each of those extracts has thousands of molecules.
Good God, I have a couple of questions that might be derailing questions.
No, go for it.
I mean, are there just like squads of guys going out being like, that looks good, like I'm going to grab this leaf?
Well, first of all, going out and finding stuff to bring back to the lab is called bioprospecting.
Like prospecting like you're a miner.
Exactly. My first thought was like, is this like Indiana Jones?
Yeah.
Sort of with his whip and a petri dish, like going out into the jungle and pulling this stuff back. And there is an element of truth to that. But finding the drug is only half the battle. The other half is making enough of the drug to actually treat people. Now, you're probably thinking, why couldn't they just recreate this molecule from scratch? Now that we've discovered it, let's just grab some beakers and we'll mix up a synthetic version in the lab. But when I say bioactive molecule, you're probably thinking of that stuff you learned in chem class. Molecules like H2O,
2 hydrogen, 1 oxygen,
or CO2,
1 carbon, 2 oxygen,
which are made up of 3 atoms.
a single molecule of the cone snail peptide we use as a painkiller is made up of 349 separate atoms glued together in an incredibly complex configuration.
102 carbon, 172 hydrogen, 36 nitrogen.
Sometimes, like in the case of the cone snail peptide, we actually do figure out how to make these big wacky molecules in the lab. But in many cases, science hasn't caught up with the complexity of nature.
So what do we do then?
What we do is we hack the natural world. You see, there are common plants that contain the basic building blocks we need to make complicated drugs. With a little sunlight and some water, these plants can perform all of the complicated chemical steps we don't yet understand. So what we do is we take these plants, we grow them in bulk, and we harvest them just like you would for food, and then we use them as the raw materials for our most complicated molecules.
When you say common plants, are we talking about like potatoes?
More like beans.
Like black beans?
Taco beans?
Pinto beans? Magic beans. Magic beans.
Okay, you're going to find out soon enough what kind of beans. Mm. Because the next part of this story is all about how we use these raw materials. And it starts with a guy named Percy Levon Julian.
Have you ever heard of him? No.
4 pregnine, 3 11 20 trione.
Percy Julian was a renowned black chemist born in 1899 in Montgomery, Alabama.
He loved to tell stories.
That's his granddaughter, Kathy.
He had a very easy smile, very bright smile.
He played the piano.
Was kind of the life of the party.
And he was obsessed with plants.
Even neighbors would talk about the yard that, particularly in the spring, my grandfather loved to plant tulips.
Hundreds and hundreds of tulips.
And so these fascinating laboratories of the plant really makes the psalmist's words true. Consider the lilies of the field, they toil not, neither do they spin.
And later in his career, he focused on using the products made by plants to make drugs.
And yet Solomon, in all his glory, was not arrayed like one of these.
That was him?
That was him.
He's very sonorous.
He is. Oh, and that other guy is named Stephen Lyons.
Hi, is this Steve?
Yes. Hey, John.
He's a filmmaker that wrote and produced a documentary about Julian for Nova. And also helping me to tell this story is Sabrina Collins.
Can you hear me now?
She's executive director of the Marburger STEM Center at Lawrence Technological University. And the recurring themes in Julian's life story are as follows. Racism, perseverance, breakthrough.
You know, he grew up in the Jim Crow South, you know, born April 11th, 1899 in Montgomery, Alabama.
They were not allowed to eat in white people's restaurants or drink from their water fountains or use their bathrooms.
To give you an idea of the challenges that he faced, when he was 12 years old, he ran across a lynched body hanging from a tree.
Now, Percy's dad was a railroad clerk, his mother was a school teacher, and both of them believed very strongly in the power of education.
But there was a big problem. There were no high schools for African Americans in Montgomery.
So for 2 years after eighth grade, Percy takes classes at a local teacher training school. And based just on that, he manages to get into DePauw University in Greencastle, Indiana. Keep in mind, this is like the 19-teens.
He discovered soon after he got to DePauw that he was not assigned a dormitory like the other students were. He was assigned a room off campus with a slop jar for a toilet. He was told that he would have to find his meals somewhere else in town because they weren't going to serve him there in that building.
So Percy roams around for a couple of days. He winds up living in an attic of a local frat house.
He could live as long as he was willing to do work around the fraternity for the white students.
God, America is just like,
Yeah.
You continue to hear these reoccurring themes of, you know, one challenge after another.
In the classroom, he was really struggling to keep up. Remember, he didn't have the high school foundation of the other kids. He actually wrote his parents and told them that he thought they made a mistake sending him to college.
These white boys are so much smarter than I am. I don't know whether I'll ever be able to keep up with them.
But
his story really is about perseverance, resilience, and persistence, you know, because he kept going.
He starts taking remedial classes at the local high school to catch up to his white peers. And then
he eventually graduated in 1920, valedictorian of his class.
That's an American story right there.
Oh, it's just the beginning of an American story.
fast forward 10 years, Julian has his master's now from Harvard. He has become the third African-American ever to get a PhD in chemistry. And now he's started his life's work, isolating and producing medicines from plants. So the first thing he does for his dissertation, he isolates the active ingredient in an Austrian shrub called Corydalis cava, used to treat heart palpitations. And those active ingredients are tetrahydrocoptisin, hydrohadrastinin, and canidine.
Well, I don't want to frighten those of you who are not familiar with organic chemistry. One hardly expects an organic chemist to be able to speak without his gobbledygook in his language.
So victory number one.
Good job.
Earns his PhD. After that, Percy comes back to the United States, gets himself into a bit of trouble at Howard University, where he wooed another professor's wife and got canned. And he eventually lands back at his alma mater, DePauw University, as a researcher. Now, he's got a touch of academic scandal on his record, and he really needs a big win to get his career back on track. And that's when he starts in on synthesizing the chemical physostigmine.
You say them like they're so meaningful. It's like, oh my God, physostigmine!
Chemistry is hard. Chemistry is hard.
Physostigmine is a substance derived from a bean called the calabar bean.
It's a little brownish, reddish bean that's native to Africa, and this chemical that it contains, physostigmine, is super poisonous. But like the cone snail toxin, when used correctly, it doubles as a type of drug.
It was already used in the treatment of glaucoma, the eye disease glaucoma.
As a side note, way back in the day, the calabar bean was used in a Monty Python-esque tradition called a trial ordeal, where someone accused of a crime would be forced to eat this, again, super poisonous bean, and if they died, they were guilty.
Oh, God.
Anyway, the problem is Percy isn't the only scientist trying to isolate this compound that treats glaucoma.
There was a very prominent chemist named Robert Robinson at Oxford University. Robinson would go on to win the Nobel Prize in a few years. And he was working on the synthesis of physostigmine himself.
And just before Percy and his colleague Joseph Pickel succeed in being the very first to create physostigmine, Robinson publishes his own synthesis.
Ugh.
And Julian's like,
damn,
I lost.
The race is over. Robinson has won.
Yeah, I'm totally going to get fired.
I've wasted all this time.
Might as well go find someone else's wife to woo.
No, he married her.
Oh, good.
Many children.
Happy ending there.
But when he looked at the paper more closely, he realized that the melting point of a key ingredient in the synthesis in Robinson's paper...
That melting point wasn't what it was supposed to be. Robinson had screwed it up.
It turned out that Julian was right, and he and Pico went on to complete the synthesis of physostigmine, and it was a triumph. This is an unknown African-American scientist from a small college in Indiana taking on one of the most prominent chemists in the world.
It's 1935. And Percy has made himself famous in his field. But despite this, he still gets fired from DePauw.
Wait, what?
Yeah. So he starts looking for work in the private sector.
Both he and Pickel were asked to come and interview for jobs at DuPont.
A massive chemical company to this day.
What's interesting is that they offered his colleague a position, but they simply apologized to him, telling him, we didn't know that you were African-American, that you were Negro.
Next, he applies to the Institute of Paper Chemistry in Appleton, Wisconsin.
I sent many of my students from DePauw to the Institute of Paper Chemistry at Appleton for their doctor's degree.
They were planning to extend him an offer, but Appleton was known as a sundown town, so as an African American, you could not live or, you know, stay in that area.
Which said that no Negro should be bedded or boarded in the city of Appleton overnight. And so the board met in emergency session to know what they could do with this man to whom they had offered a job.
God.
Well, this actually ends up being a little bit of good luck, as it would turn out, because the vice president of another company called Glidden Paints was on the board of the Paper Chemistry Institute, and he was like, all right, you paper people are crazy. I'm going to hire this dude. And that is how Percy Julian, grandson of slaves, lands the job of a lifetime.
This is 1936, 10 years before Jackie Robinson broke into baseball, and Julian is being offered the directorship of a chemical laboratory at a major industrial company in America. It really is a remarkable thing.
And when we come back, Percy's biggest breakthrough.
Wait, we're taking a break?
Yeah, that's why I just said when we come back.
I think I'm supposed to do that kind of thing.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, good call.
When we come back, Percy's biggest breakthrough.
And so I started in on another very fascinating plant, the soybean.
The soybean?
Just wait. You'll see. That's why I did it. I did it. I know this story.
All right.
You're just going to have to wait.
When we come back. So, welcome back. I'm Sam Evans Brown. You're listening to Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. Producer Taylor Quimby was just telling us a story.
We were talking about Percy Levon Julian, chemist extraordinaire, who just landed himself an incredible, groundbreaking job directing a research lab for the Glidden Paint Company. But before we get back to his story, we need to talk a little bit about hormones.
Oh, God.
Oh, relax. And here to explain this bit is Art Greenberg.
Professor in the chemistry department at the University of New Hampshire.
He was just about to donate a pint of blood when I talked to him.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'll give an extra one for you.
Okay, good, good. So let's set the scene. It's the mid-1930s. World War II is just around the corner. And never mind cone snail toxins, scientists at this point are only just discovering the hormones and steroids produced inside the human body. One of those hormones that has just been discovered is called progesterone. And all scientists really know about progesterone is that it has something to do with preparing the uterus for childbirth. Which seems super important, so naturally doctors want to investigate. There's just one big issue. In order to study progesterone, you've got to get your hands on it. And that requires organs.
Ugh.
Lots and lots of organs.
I thought we were going to say toads.
You know, taking an organ, for example, ovaries, and taking a vast amount of ovaries, basically grinding them up almost like you'd make a milkshake, and then basically using various means to extract, using solvents, until you finally get an active material.
Let's just move on quickly from that image.
Oh, well, I'm sorry, because the next clip is worse.
Oh, God.
Cow ovaries? Or, you know, like, do you know what...
Sure. You know, we could be talking about the ovaries of pigs. So, for example, from progesterone, the company Schering took something like 50,000 sows back in 1934. And from these sows, they removed 625 kilograms. That's about 1,300 pounds of sow ovaries. And from this, immense amount of material, they got 20 milligrams of active progesterone.
Good Lord.
Yeah, the ovaries of 50,000 pigs for less than a thimbleful of progesterone.
But that was enough. Was it enough?
No, that is not nearly enough. That's exactly the problem. You can't research that. You can't treat a patient with a thimbleful of progesterone. This is the state of hormone research in the 1930s when Percy Julian starts working as the director of the Glidden Paints Soya Division. It's one in which we are starting to learn that this stuff is out there, but we have no access to it.
No idea how to get it, yeah. Or we have an idea how to get it in like the dumbest way imaginable.
Okay, so back to our story. The first thing Percy does at Glidden is he isolates and unlocks a powerful component that lives within the otherwise humble soybean.
50% of the weight of the soybean is protein. And what a protein?
Percy figures out how to separate massive quantities of this stuff. He calls it alpha protein. And what makes it special is that no other protein that we've known
comes so nearly to the basic protein of animals and humans as soybean protein.
Now, the reason a paint company is interested in soybeans is because they think this protein can be used to make paints stick better in cold weather. But this alpha protein is the first vegetable protein produced anywhere in the United States, and it also ends up in every freaking product that you could possibly imagine.
It was used as a paper coating.
It's the chief ingredient in a firefighting foam that servicemen call bean soup,
credited with saving thousands of servicemen on ships during the war.
From soybean oil, which is a similar related product, came lecithin.
New salad oils and shortenings and margarines and dog food.
Because you need protein in dog food since you're not going to actually have good quality meat. Guess what? Soybean protein.
From soybean meal came
plastics,
linoleum, plywood.
You name it, this stuff is everywhere. And then one day,
Percy is at the factory where they're separating all these soy proteins and oils. And this guy runs up to him and is like, Dr. Julian, Dr. Julian, there's a vat of soybean oil that's been spoiled.
He says, the water's leaked into it and it's full of white solids. It's just full of white solids floating around in it.
This, by the way, is a 100,000-gallon tank of soybean oil.
And it weighed at that time $160,000.
So Julian is understandably kind of freaking out right now.
I said, what? Then I was over there in a jiffy.
But when he sees it, Percy recognizes the white stuff. It was a substance called stigmasterol, which is a type of steroid produced by soybeans.
We centrifuged that oil and got out these white solids, and we sold them promptly for $200 a pound.
This is the difference between geniuses and the rest of us. So I would have just thrown that out.
$160,000 down the drain.
Let's just, go pour it in the parking lot.
We got more money out of the soybean sterols than we would have gotten out the whole tank of oil. Why? Because the sex hormones could be made from these soybean sterols.
Wait, sex hormones?
Yes. I mentioned that stigmasterol is a steroid. Well, you know what else is a steroid? Progesterone. Also testosterone, estrogen, cholesterol. And since these steroids all have the same basic skeleton, the same underlying chemical structure, scientists can take one steroid, stigmasterol, and transform it into another one, progesterone.
So instead of having 50,000 sows to get a thimbleful of this stuff, you can just add water to a vat of soybean goop and pow, you've got it.
No pigs necessary.
Gluten became a major manufacturer of human sex hormones, not just progesterone, but also testosterone. In fact, they became one of the largest suppliers of hormones in the world at the time. This is a paint company.
We got busy with this soybean.
So his work here directly led to the creation of the birth control pill. It dramatically increased access to research and treatment using hormones, testosterone, progesterone. And all of this, all of it comes from the soybean.
So then what's his legacy then? I mean, is that where we're headed to next?
Well, for me, it keeps coming back to those three themes. Again and again, Percy is confronted by racism. Again and again, he refuses to back down. And again, he accomplishes these historic feats using plants to create medicine. His granddaughter, Kathy, told me that around 1950, he bought a house in Oak Park, this very wealthy suburb of Chicago that up until this point was entirely white.
And just before they were going to move in, the house, someone, broke into the home and poured kerosene throughout the home and set it on fire.
They repaired the house, they moved in, and not too long after that, someone threw a stick of dynamite at the house.
And yet my grandfather really was determined he was not going to move. He was going to stay there.
At Glidden, Percy went on to synthesize another incredibly important substance from soybeans, a substance that was instrumental in lowering the price of cortisone, a medication for arthritis that was almost impossible to get prior to the 1950s.
Once cortisone became more available, I remember that a woman who had had very severe rheumatoid arthritis sent my grandfather a doll that she had knitted.
And then he left Glidden to start his own company, Julian Laboratories, which was this incredibly progressive company at a time where there weren't a lot of role models in science for African Americans.
Because he started his own laboratory, he was able to hire women and people of color, other chemists, give them opportunities that they otherwise would not have had.
And Julian went on to become the second African American and the first African American chemist to be elected to the National Academy of Science. So I've been trying to think about what Percy's story tells us about medicine today. And what I've come up with is that we've come a long way since we were slaughtering 50,000 pigs for a thimbleful of progesterone. We've discovered tons of new drugs and found more efficient ways of manufacturing them. Cortisone today comes from a type of grass. Progesterone from Mexican yams now instead of soybeans. But when it comes to unlocking these medical secrets hidden in nature, the truth is we haven't come all that far. Barry O'Keefe, the natural products guy at the National Cancer Institute, he told me something that kind of freaked me out a little bit.
And sometimes I feel like there's this impression that maybe that we don't, it's not that we know all there is to know, but that
you know, the sort of world of molecules and chemistry and organic chemistry is pretty well figured out. But from what I hear from you, I mean, it really sounds like...
it's not the case at
all. We know nothing.
I mean, at this point, estimates are that less than 1% of the biome has been evaluated chemically. So greater than 99% of the creatures out there that might be making interesting molecules have never been looked at.
So when he says 99% haven't been looked at, does that mean that there are just scores of molecules, chemicals, compounds that could exist that we don't even know if they exist or don't?
Yeah.
We wouldn't know about nicotine receptors in the body if no one had discovered nicotine. We wouldn't know about opioid receptors if no one had ever discovered opioids in the first place. So a lot of what we understand about human physiology is also based upon someone discovering an interesting molecule and then figuring how that works.
I think I'm starting to get a grip on what you were wrestling with there in that interview, which is, you know, on the atomic level, we've got the periodic table.
Yeah.
And it seems so comprehensible. It's like, look, they're the building blocks. And we know what those do. We know how they interact with each other. But what I think you're saying is that when you go up one level from that, that all of the various combinations of those building blocks, we've just barely scratched the surface.
Exactly. And the reason that this is so concerning, the reason it makes me really uneasy, well, remember that painkiller that was developed from a cone snail peptide?
Yeah.
Well, Harvard's Ari Bernstein had this to say about that discovery.
So that's one peptide out of probably 200 or 300 in the one species. There are some 700 species. You do the math, we're looking at somewhere between 70,000, 140,000 peptides in this genus. We have studied maybe 100 in any detail from about a dozen species. I mentioned that cone snails live on or in coral reefs. Coral reefs are some of the most endangered habitats on Earth. They're also one of the most biodiverse habitats on Earth. There may be as many as 1 in 10 species that we can see that are either living on coral reefs or dependent upon coral reefs for their survival.
So I knew we were going here.
You knew that this was coming up.
I knew we were going
here. Yeah, in the end, this is a climate change story. It was unavoidable. And it's not an empty threat. We already have examples where compounds that might have been super useful to us have vanished from the face of the Earth. For example, there was this rare type of frog that in the 80s scientists were studying called the gastric brooding frog. It actually carried its babies in its stomach. And there were signs that these frogs produced some sort of magic molecule that might have been used to treat ulcers or gastric disease. But
both species of gastric brooding frog, the only ones on Earth, went extinct right at that time. And these frogs could have potentially yielded medical advances in treatment or prevention that we will never obtain because they're gone.
You know, I make these noises whenever depressing subjects come up. And it's not because I don't want to go there.
Wait, what noises?
Yeah. And it's because, like, oh, man, it's so easy to feel overwhelmed by when you start to get into what we could be missing out on.
Yeah.
So easy.
Well, I mean, I saw it this way, which is that this is really an amazing story about just incredible ingenuity of human beings. That somebody looked at this deadly fish-hunting snail and thought, maybe we could use this poison as a drug, is incredible. Yeah. I mean, the fact that we can take a soybean and create a human sex steroid. Yeah, a human sex hormone. That's crazy. That is crazy.
Yeah.
And it's only at the end that we have to take this step back and recognize that some of the crazy discoveries yet to be made are, as we speak, slipping through our fingers.
This is where we're headed. This is what we have wrought for ourselves.
Yeah, this is where we're headed. There's still amazing stuff on the horizon.
Yeah.
There's still lots of amazing stuff on the horizon. But we'll never know what could have been.
And so these fascinating laboratories of the plant really make the psalmist's words true. Consider the lilies of the field. They toil not, neither do they spin. And yet Solomon, in all his glory, was not arrayed like one of these.
Outside In is produced by me, Sam Evans-Brown, Maureen McMurray, Taylor Quimby, Logan Shannon, Molly Donahue, and Jimmy Gutierrez. Special thanks to Marianne Savarese, Jennifer Chisholm, and Paula Mann with Healthcare for the Homeless in Manchester, and Dave Munson and Travis Baggett with Healthcare for the Homeless of Boston. Also, a big thanks to Nick Cerulla for hooking us up with Tony Bosco. If you want to see some pictures from Tony's camp, check out our website, outsideinradio.org.
I dream in colors, I smell in my dreams, I fight, I learn how to knife fight in my dreams because I lost quite often. Don't sit back and defend, attack, because first cut is the deepest. I didn't make that one up, I heard that on the radio. But anyway, I told the camera that.
Also, thanks to the Julian family for letting us use the fantastic tape of Dr. Percy Julian and the American Chemical Society for helping us wade through the science for this episode, because science is complicated.
I remember as an undergraduate, I asked my advisor, how does this bond cross over that bond? And what my advisor said to me, says, Art, he says, balls and sticks are not molecules.
Our theme is by Breakmaster Cylinder. Additional music today by Blue Dot Sessions, David Sestay, Joseph C. Smith's Orchestra, Poddington Bear, and Ty Gibbons. I'm Sam Evans-Brown. Outside In is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.
By the way, you are incorrect when you're like, oh no, it gets worse. The milkshake of pig organs is the worst image.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh.